Iranian president says the West's accusations against Tehran's peaceful nuclear program show they seek to achieve political goals through JCPOA revival talks. Iran censures the U.S. for the impasse in the talks to revive the JCPOA, saying it wants objective guarantees that Washington won't torpedo the deal again. Also ahead, Ecuador's government and indigenous groups sign an agreement to end days-long protests over living costs and fuel prices that had paralyzed the country. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Iran's president says the Western accusations against his country's peaceful nuclear program are aimed at achieving political goals through JCPOA negotiations. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with the Emir of Qatar, Sheikh Tamim bin Hamad Al Thani. Raisi said the UN nuclear agency has confirmed in its multiple reports that Iran's nuclear program is transparent and has never deviated from its legal course. Iran's president also described unilateral sanctions on the country over its nuclear program as illegal and oppressive. Raisi said achieving a lasting agreement on the JCPOA hinges on the removal of sanctions and putting an unconditional end to baseless claims. He said Iran is determined to defend its rights and wants all sanctions removed. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has once again blamed Washington for the current impasse in negotiations on the revival of the 2015 deal. In a statement to the UN Security Council meeting, Majid Takht-Ravanchi also censured European signatories to the JCPOA for failing to fulfill their obligations and promises. He said Iran was denied its rights promised in the accord due to the Europeans' failure. Takht-Ravanchi said Iran began the revival talks in Vienna with good faith and maximum flexibility, but Washington's unrealistic and rigid approach led to the current stalemate. He also criticized the International Atomic Energy Agency for its counterproductive approach by issuing a U.S. proposed resolution against Iran. Takht-Ravanchi said Iran is still ready to engage constructively for a good deal, but he said Tehran is after, quote, verifiable and objective guarantees from the U.S. that the deal will not be torpedoed again. Takht-Ravanchi also said the EU facilitated indirect talks between Tehran and Washington in Doha earlier this week were, quote, serious and positive. Political commentator Robert Fantina says the United States' unrealistic demands have been the main obstacles to reviving the 2015 deal.
The United States will not make any changes. The United States is, as it has been from the start of the talks to rejuvenate the JCPOA, has been unrealistic in its demands. The United States violated the agreement, therefore it must unilaterally re-enter the agreement. There is no reason for any discussions. Iran does not have to make any further concessions. The United States violated the agreement, which was a violation of international law, and the United States needs to come back into it. That President Joe Biden is not willing to do so indicates that the U.S. is not serious about the agreement and has no real interest in maintaining it. It will only do so if to its knees, which has not happened since Trump pulled out in 2018, and is not going to happen. So the United States is causing this stalemate, and it is the United States that can release it and start constructive talks by being realistic once again.
And Tehran says a joint anti-Iran statement by the leaders of Bahrain and Egypt was, quote, biased and unconstructive. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman says certain motives and agendas were the driving force behind allegations against Iran. Nasser Kanani urged the two Arab states to get a better understanding of regional equations and Iran's stabilizing role in West Asia. He cautioned against taking the, quote, wrong and unwise path of spreading Iranophobia. The Iranian officials said such an approach serves Israel's interests. Kanani also said Iran's defense and missile capabilities pose no threat to its neighbors. He said Iran is determined to boost friendly ties with its neighbors, including Arabs. On Wednesday, Egypt's president and Bahrain's king issued a statement following a meeting in Manama. The statement accused Iran of destabilizing activities in the region. Iran's foreign minister reiterates Tehran's opposition to the war in Ukraine, saying the Islamic Republic is ready to contribute to a diplomatic solution to the crisis. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Dmytro Kuleba. He said Tehran is ready to be part of an agreement in a Black Sea corridor that would see the release of much-needed Ukrainian grain to world markets. Amir Abdullahian also invited Kuleba to pay a visit to Iran. For his part, the Ukrainian foreign minister hailed Tehran's position regarding the war in his country. He said Kiev welcomes any political support that would help bring an end to the ongoing crisis in Ukraine. Iran has marked the National Day of Fight against chemical and biological weapons. The occasion is to commemorate the victims of the Sardasht chemical attacks launched by former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in June 1987. Saman Khajuri has more.
The Iranian city of Sardasht in West Azerbaijan province is the third city after Japan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki, which became the target of weapons of mass destruction in the world. In June 1987, Iraqi warplanes dropped mustard gas bombs on Sardasht in two separate bombing runs on four residential areas. The gas attacks occurred during the Iraqi-imposed war on Iran, when Iraq frequently used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and soldiers. According to official reports, out of 12,000 inhabitants of Sardasht, over 8,000 were chemically wounded, while 130 people died of the mustard gas attack.
After 3 decades, the city of Sardasht is still reeling from the consequences of Iraq's chemical bombardment, since many of the survivors still have to live with the long-term respiratory and even psychological effects of inhaling mustard gas used in the attack.
In April 2004, the Tehran Public Court found the government of the United States liable for the attacks through its support for the regime of Saddam Hussein. The U.S. government was ordered to pay $600 million in compensation to the victims.
The chemical attack survivors fell victim to some Western government's inhumane policies. When Western companies gave Saddam's regime chemical materials and technology for production of chemical weapons, with the representatives of their government in the UN Security Council remaining silent, turning a blind eye to Saddam's chemical crimes and letting him continue using chemical weapons against combatants and civilians. The U.S. and its allies are the main perpetrator of this heinous crime.
Saddam's regime used chemical weapons against Iranian forces and civilians more than 300 times during the 8-year war, leading to the injury of more than 100,000 people, including thousands of civilians. Over 400 Western companies equipped Saddam with chemical and biological weapons. According to available documents, most of these companies belonged to Germany, Britain, and France.
Despite the passage of 35 years from the Sardasht chemical bombings, still the families of victims urged the international community to bring the main perpetrators of the crimes to justice. But their call seemed to have fallen on deaf ears so far. Saman Khajuri, Tehran.
In Ecuador, the government and indigenous groups have signed an agreement on ending protests over President Guillermo Lasso's economic policies. The agreement includes the cessation of the protests and the gradual return of demonstrators to their cities. It also provides for a 5% gallon reduction in the price of diesel and gasoline, on top of a 10% cut, or 10 cents that is cut, already conceded by the government. Talks between the two sides resumed after a short pause on Thursday to end the protests that had paralyzed the country since June the 13th. For nearly 3 weeks, indigenous demonstrators protested against high living costs and fuel prices. Several people died after some rallies turned violent. Road blockades by protesters led to shortages of food and medical supplies. The country's oil production has also plummeted by more than a half. Tunisia has published the draft of a new constitution that gives more explicit powers to the president. The draft is set to go to a referendum on July the 25th. It provides for a presidential system in a split from the mixed presidential parliamentary system under the country's 2014 constitution. The president would be the head of the armed forces. The document would also water down the role of parliament. The president could serve two terms of 5 years each and has the right to dissolve parliament. The draft has been written by legal experts close to President Kais Saied, who last July sacked the government and froze parliament. His actions have been described by his critics as a power grab. Some Tunisians have, however, welcomed his moves. Britain has accused Russia of using food as a weapon of war, yet London itself has often resorted to blockades in an apparent attempt to push its colonial ambitions. After all, starvation has been a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects.
Since the start of the war in Ukraine back in February, the prices of commodities have risen up sharply. But the rising prices of grain raise concerns about possible famine in different parts of the world. Russia and Ukraine together export nearly a third of the world's wheat and barley, more than 70% of its sunflower oil, and are prominent suppliers of corn. Russia is also the top global fertilizer producer. Russia has been accused of disruption in the transport of grain harvest in Ukraine. UN projections show that up to 181 million people in 41 countries could face a food crisis or even an outright famine. UK's Foreign Secretary Liz Truss has accused Moscow of using grain as a weapon.
Food should never be used as a weapon of war, but that's what we're seeing in Ukraine, with Putin's forces blocking the ports and stopping grain being exported around the world.
However, a look at history and UK's global imperialism reveals that London has often resorted to blockades to further its colonial ambitions. Starvation was a conscious resource for Britain's colonial projects. The starvation approach was used against countries like Ireland, Iran, India, Malaysia, and Nigeria. Meanwhile, blockades and sanctions has been used against a whole host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe, to name a few, which all point to how the UK has used food as a weapon of war.
The UK throne symbolizes all forms of evil and genocide that we can imagine in human history. And England and the Crown in particular are the representatives of that. For centuries, they have extracted their wealth from oppressed peoples around the world, have shored up their pockets, have used financial schemes to colonize and oppress peoples around the world, to divide and conquer oppressed peoples in order to gain wealth.
Aside from the UK using food as a weapon of war, there are other violations Britain has done. Sanctions, for instance, the UK has used blockades on a host of countries like Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, and Zimbabwe. When Iran was occupied by the British and Soviet forces in World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
The famine of 1845 to 1852 in Ireland was a man-made instrument of war and conquest. Over a million Irish people died of starvation. A million and a half more left Ireland, many on coffin ships. Before the genocide, the population of Ireland stood at over 8 million. 150 years later, and the population has never reached that figure. Mass starvation was a regular feature of life in India under British rule. The last famine that was inflicted on India was in 1943, when over 4 million people died in Bengal. The British Army took millions of tons of rice from starving people. Even when other nations tried to send aid to the people of Bengal, Winston Churchill refused the offers. Britain's imperial project in India, its aim and methods was not to prevent famines, but to engineer them. During the so-called Malayan Emergency of 1948 to 1960, the British introduced a food denial program called Operation Starvation. Its aim was to starve out those who were resisting Britain's looting of the country. When Iran was occupied by British and Russian forces during World War I and II, countless Iranians died because they were denied food by the occupying imperial forces.
It has been involved with certain genocides and, of course, the first war in Iran and so forth to kill, thousands of lives lost of Iranians. If we look back in history, this has not been, it has not only happened once, it has happened many times.
Iran declared itself neutral in both wars, but millions of Iranians lost their lives due to widespread famine and disease. In the late 1960s, the British armed and supplied Nigeria with mercenaries during the Biafran War in the name of protecting corporate oil. When it looked like Nigeria got the upper hand, Britain increased the supply of arms and ammunition. Britain supported a blockade against them, which resulted in countless people starving to death. The UK's imperial history shows that the regime in London tends not to care about the plight of people facing famine and hunger. And London's comments about using grain as weapon are a ploy to conceal its dark history.
That brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
More than two-thirds of American women disapprove of the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to overturn the landmark abortion rights case Roe v. Wade, a new opinion poll has found. The article you're about to hear has been written by Newsweek journalist Xander Landon. The article has been published by Newsweek and is titled Supreme Court overturning Roe met with 67% disapproval among women. On Friday, 24th of June, the court released the opinion in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization, which ended a woman's constitutionally protected right to an abortion at the federal level and leaves it up to the states to implement their own abortion policies. Some U.S. states are immediately moving to impose trigger laws to ban the procedure, while some experts estimate that without Roe v. Wade, abortion is likely to become illegal in about half of the country. The opinion poll conducted by CBS News YouGov surveyed 1,591 people on Friday and Saturday after the court released its opinion that overturned the 1973 landmark decision. 59% of those surveyed said they disapproved of the decision to overturn the Roe v. Wade ruling, while 41% said they approved. Meanwhile, 67% of American women and 51% of men said they disapproved of overturning Roe v. Wade. On the other hand, 49% of men approved of the court's actions, while only 33% of women did. The survey's breakdown fell largely along party lines, with 83% of Democrats saying they disapproved of the Supreme Court's actions, while 78% of Republicans said they approved. The opinion poll also asked respondents whether or not they believe abortion should be legal in their state. 64% said they believe abortion should be legal in all or most cases, while 36% said it should be illegal in all or most cases. While 31% of those surveyed said they believed the decision was a step forward for America, 52% said it represented a step backward for America. Only 17% said it represented neither. An opinion poll conducted by Yahoo News and YouGov in May, more than a month before the Supreme Court's ultimate decision was finalized, found that only 31% of Americans supported overturning Roe v. Wade. In the wake of the court's actions on Friday, 24th of June, conservatives celebrated the decision, while Democrats blasted it. On Friday, after the news about the overturn was announced, President Joe Biden said it was a very solemn moment for the United States. The Supreme Court expressly took away a constitutional right from the American people that it had already recognized. They simply took it away. That's never been done to a right that is so important to so many Americans, Biden said. CBS News said the margin of error for its opinion poll was 3%. Meanwhile, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez suggested on Sunday, 26th of June, that Supreme Court justices should face impeachment if they lied about their stance on Roe v. Wade during their confirmation hearings. After the Supreme Court overturned the landmark case that guaranteed American women the right to an abortion, attention turned to the conservative justices' remarks during their confirmation hearings, as many of them suggested they believed the case to be settled by law, only to go on to rule it unconstitutional. During their confirmation hearings, Chief Justices Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh called the case an important precedent, which led some senators to believe they would uphold the case and voted them through. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a New York Democrat, accused the justices of lying under oath, warning that not impeaching them would send a blaring signal to future Supreme Court nominees that they can lie to secure their confirmation during an appearance on NBC News' Meet the Press program.
Food for thought.
Salam and heartfelt condolences to you all on the sad martyrdom anniversary of the Prophet's 9th infallible successor, Imam Muhammad Taqi al-Jawad, peace upon him, whose life was cut short in the prime of youth. Here we present you a saying from this repository of divine wisdom. To show a matter before preparing for it properly is spoiling it.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the good manner in the Islamic lifestyle. When we talk about good manner, it has a general meaning and it has a specific meaning. When we look at the Islamic text, we see that its general meaning is to have good characteristics in yourself, which can help your soul to go towards the perfection. But when it refers to a specific meaning, it means to have kindness with the people. It means to have a good behavior with the people. It means to socialize with the people in a good manner. And you become a person who has been seen as a good person in the society. This is what it specifically means in the Islamic teachings. If we look around us, we can see that there are many people who look good, as their appearance. They have a good appearance, they have a good clothing, maybe the way they talk, it's impressive or it's attractive. But on the other hand, whenever something happens to them, maybe some mishappening is happening, we see that the characteristics that we have made in our mind, the picture that we had of that person in our mind, it's been destroyed, and we see another person over there. Therefore, when in the Islamic perspective we talk about the good manner, it means that in all kinds, in all ways, in all scenarios, the person should have the kindness in himself. He should be behaving in a good way so that whenever people see him, they love that person. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of good manner in the Islamic lifestyle, and we said that the good manner in its specific meaning has a special meaning. Whereas we can also see that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, when he talks about the good manner, which is known as husn khulq in the Arabic terminology or other the Islamic terms, we see that he says that husn khulq or the good manner is something that when you are facing someone, you face him in a soft way. You face him with purification. You face him with kindness. And whenever your brothers in Iman, when they see you, even if you are in the hard time, they see you as a person who is relaxed, as a person who never leaves his kindness to the people. And he always pay attention to the manners that he must observe. It doesn't matter whether there was a mishap with him. It doesn't matter whether someone has insulted him. Because in the history, if we see, we also see that there was a guy who came from Syria to Medina, and he was abusing and using bad words for Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. And whereas Imam Hassan, when he faced him and he saw him like he's abusing and he's insulting Imam, he never said anything. Rather, he said, "It looks like you're a passenger and you're a traveler. You need a place to sleep. Your clothes are dirty. You need some place to wash your clothes, to have a bath. You need a clean place to sleep, so I can provide everything to you." So this was the manner of Imam Hassan, which changed that guy who came and who was from the enemies of Imam Hassan, and later he became from the lovers of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Chilean scientists believe they have found the world's oldest living tree in a lush green forest in the south of the country. The scientists say their study shows an ancient cypress known as the Great Grandfather might have been beaten the record for the world's oldest tree by 6 centuries. The bristlecone pine tree in eastern California is the current record holder with over 4,800 years of age. The scientist who led the study says the sample they extracted and other dating methods suggest that the Chilean cypress with a 4-meter thick trunk is over 5,000 years old.
We could count all the rings, but we know it's not the tree's age. It's an estimation of what we call a minimum age. So for this kind of tree, the scientific challenge is to estimate with science the part that we do not see and that is missing. And that is what we did with the millennial alerce. This method tells us that 80% of all possible growth trajectories give us an age of this living tree greater than 5,000 years. There's only a 20% chance that the tree is younger.
Borisovich is, however, concerned about visitors harming the tree, which is located in the Kostero National Park. He says visitors are still able to circle the tree's base, step on its roots, and even take pieces of its bark. The tree is a conifer native to Chile and Argentina and can grow to heights of up to 45 meters. With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle has also has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up a Pushpa tree and plant hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe, and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe, and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail. Deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge. Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge is 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtanaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems. But think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset. Just tagged the giant, a 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Paraná to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far, only two other similar collections have been found in smaller forest areas of Brazil and Argentina. Agriculture is no exception when it comes to adapting new technologies in the context of changing climate. Now, French farmers in the northwestern suburbs of Paris grow greens in any season using hydroponic farms. Residents of a housing estate have ditched the traditional way of farming to create jobs for their community. Hydroponic farming is a method of growing plants in water, not in soil. It may sound like it would be a complicated process, but it's actually quite straightforward. The system is made of plastic and uses a rich organic ecosystem. The workers use less water than usual and do not even need a teaspoon of soil. One of the employees describes how they turn barren land into a farm.
It used to be a garage where they stored cars, but since there were no more cars, we used it as a dormitory. We listened to music and watched football matches. We used to meet here to have a bit of privacy and breathe, to hide away for a while. But now that it's become a place of work, I'm happy because I'm working.
Hydroponic farms can be used to grow products of all kinds in any region. In this one, farmers are planting all sorts of things, ranging from Peruvian mint to Vietnamese coriander. They hope that the system can be used to help local residents, especially those who need it the most.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Children rummage through Deir al-Balah Dam on a constant basis. Among them is an 11-year-old called Fadi. He goes to the dam located in central Gaza after school each day. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Ola Musam, writer. This article is published under the heading Danger doesn't stop children from working in Gaza's dumps. Stay tuned for more. Children rummage through Deir al-Balah's dump on a constant basis. Among them is an 11-year-old called Fadi. He goes to the dump located in central Gaza after school each day. "We have no choice," says his father Mustafa, who accompanies Fadi as they research for material they can retrieve and sell to recycling plants, adding, "If we don't do this, we will starve to death." Mustafa, a mechanic, has been unemployed for 7 years now. Both he and Fadi have been injured while working at the dam. The dangers of this work were demonstrated earlier this year. In January, Osama al-Sarsik, 14, died at a dump in Johr al-Lik, south of Gaza City. Osama had gone to work at the dump with his father, Arafat. Together, they would collect any plastic and metal, particularly copper and aluminum, they could sell. "We had to make a living. It was a cold, rainy day," Arafat said, adding, "but the weather didn't stop us. We had to make a living." They had been at the dump for approximately 2 hours when Arafat realized that Osama was missing. Arafat's first thought was that his son had been attacked by dogs. Osama's body was found following a lengthy search, and it was determined that he died from traumatic asphyxia. Arafat relies on his meager earnings from collecting recyclable material to feed his family. For the past 4 years, he has had no other source of income. Osama was the eldest of his 5 children. The child's death prompted the Gaza municipality to ban the public from accessing the dump. The ban was contested by a number of people who depend on collecting reusable or recyclable waste for a living. According to Marwan Al-Ghul, an official with the municipality, most people who collect material from the dump are unaware of how dangerous their work can be. He said, "They are just trying to make ends meet. We're trying to find a solution urgently, especially because child labor is increasing due to the Zionist regime's blockade." Omar, a father of 7, has refused to stop collecting waste from dumps. 2 of his sons, aged 18 and 10, work with him. He said, "Sometimes I am not able to provide enough food for my family." A blacksmith by training, Omar has long been unemployed. By collecting waste, he only makes a small sum, up to $9 per day. "When I started doing this work, I felt ashamed," he said, adding, "but I no longer do. No one can stop me from scavenging. The officials want to stop us, but I and many others will keep doing this work. I don't want to do it, but I also don't want my children to starve." The latest available data from the Palestinian Central Bureau of Statistics suggests that less than 1% of Gaza's children aged between 10 and 17 do either paid or unpaid work. Gaza's Social Development Ministry, nonetheless, believes that child labor is on the rise due to the Zionist regime's blockade. Earlier this year, the ministry undertook a survey of 10,000 families in various parts of Gaza with an income of less than $250. The survey, so far unpublished, found that 60% of parents who responded would be willing to have their children working as a last resort. Child labor in Gaza is the result of poverty, the Israeli regime blockade, and unemployment, said Iman Omar, a social worker with the ministry. "Most of the children who work also go to school. They work with their fathers or brothers in dumps or selling things," he said. Sharif, 9, collects plastic material, empty cans, and other metals from Gaza's streets every day. As his father is dead, Sharif works to support his family. He said, "And I want to save enough money so that I can buy a smartphone. And all my schoolmates have smartphones and they watch soap operas and cartoons. We don't have a computer or a phone in our home." Another boy doing similar work is 11-year-old Husam. His father has a disability and has long been unemployed. Street cleaners and other people have tried to stop Hossam from collecting material, but he has kept doing so. He loads all the plastic and metals that he gathers from dumps and from streets onto a cart, which his older brother then brings to a recycling plant. The only significant precaution he takes is that he avoids dumps near hospitals, out of fear he will be contaminated by discarded syringes. Along with his brother, Hossam can make about $6 per day. He goes to a dump early each morning in the hope that he will be the first person there. Hossam said, "Some days I cannot collect anything. That's because there are so many other children and even adults doing this kind of work."
This is my home land.
The Gaza Strip has been suffering a crisis and difficult humanitarian circumstances. Israel started two wars on Gaza that resulted in destroying the infrastructure and ruining most fields. Israel has been imposing a siege on the Strip for more than 7 years, in addition to blocking the crossings and preventing people from traveling. Palestinian women played a significant role in highlighting these issues in media.
This indicates that the Palestinian society is developed and knows the importance of media. It was introduced to it in a miserable condition, as Israel is imposing a blockade and encroaching the Palestinians. Therefore, there must be a Palestinian reaction to document this situation. So, the Palestinians' media was the first to play the role in this field by graduating a Palestinian generation that is aware of what happens.
Practically, the beginning of journalism and production companies in the Gaza Strip witnessed a difficulty in women engagement. I can say that I lived two eras. The first was at the age of 16, which was too early and media was not developed. After that, people got used to intensive presence of media, women working there, and partnership between both genders. Why did it become normal? It was because the society realized that media is the base in the life of a society like Palestinians. We are the owners of a cause. This cause is only expressed to the whole world through media.
We started with the number of 100, then 200 after a few years. The number was constant for 4 to 5 years until 3 years ago. There were 650 students. Now there are 1,100 students enrolled in the Faculty of Journalism. The female students were forming 50% of the total number in the past years. However, it became 60 to 62%. And the rest are male students.
We receive applications of joining the journalist syndicate every day, especially of female journalism graduates. Female members of the syndicate are nearly 30% in whole Palestine and 25% in Gaza. This number is a good one for them as females.
Arab women in general suffer, in an Eastern society, from some traditions and beliefs that prevent them from working in certain careers. One of these careers is media and journalism. However, Palestinian women, in particular, were distinguished with making some breakthroughs. They achieved tangible success in careers related to radio and television in general, either as camera women, video editors, producers, directors, or anchors.
We as journalists are capable of delivering our message to the world through the culture and the mind energy we have. This happens through what happens around us and what we live. The University of Palestine has more than one major of media. There are public relations, interpretation, electronic journalism, and radio and television. This way, students have the opinion to choose one of these majors with what suits their